Watching a movie would be a very different experience without music. I mean, how would we know when to feel tension or affection? What would be the sounds we'd hear from all those montages of people having whirlwind romances? Fortunately, we don't have to know, because music has been part of movies since before the people on the screen could be heard talking. And three practitioners of the art of making music, for the screen and otherwise, join us in the studio. Joby Talbot is a composer who's written for several movies over the years and has been at the Exchange before. Good to see you once again, Joby.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Tessa Brinkman has been here before as well, also a composer and musician. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
And Terry Longshore back for, boy, the second time in a couple of months, it seems like, at the Exchange. But we get you in different combinations, sometimes with Tessa and sometimes with other people. Good to have you back here as well.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
All of them live in the Ashland area and will be on a panel about making movie music this weekend at the Ashland Independent Film Festival. So for Joby, this actually goes back quite a few years, doesn't it, making music for the movies?
Yeah, I've been doing it for as long as I can remember. I started out, the first movies I ever scored were silent movies, commissions from the British Film Institute. And then from there I got into more conventional TV and movies. And the most recent thing I did was that animated film Sing that was out last year. Sing 2, I think, is in the pipes, all very exciting. But for the film festival, we're revisiting a silent movie that I scored back in 2001.
Is that The Dying Swan?
The Dying Swan, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's this exquisite movie by a Russian director called Yevgeny Bauer. This guy was unknown in the West. He was a Russian, I think, theater director who obviously got hold of a camera and made 30 films between 1916 and 1919 when he died in the Spanish flu epidemic. And his stuff was completely unknown outside of Russia until the 80s, where some archivists found a big pile of cans of film in the basement of some production company in Moscow. And discovered that tons of the amazing technical innovations that had been attributed to later directors in the 20s and 30s, he'd actually been doing all along. For example, the very first tracking shot in all movies, which is where the camera follows a moving object along in parallel, was in The Dying Swan itself. And it has all kinds of cool, nightmarish effects and kind of psychological melodrama. And I wrote the score for piano, violin, and cello that we're going to perform live on Saturday night.
I am surprised that the film survived. I mean, we're talking 100 years plus in some of these cases that the films of this Russian director survived.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of miraculous. I mean, they're in a pretty parlous state, but the renovators at the BFI managed to cobble it together so that it's not too kind of patchy. There's bits where you think obviously some like lichen started to grow on the film and it looks suddenly very, very patchy for a while, but no, you really get a sense of what it would have looked like when it was pristine, and it's exquisite. I mean, in such a fascinating period in history, of course, Russia in 1916, you're looking at all these actors and you think you've got no idea what's around the corner.
Truly, yeah, because the revolution was the next year, and the end of the World War, and boy, the rest of the world changing drastically in the years beyond that. That's some great stuff to think about. Mm. So, Tessa Brinkman and Terry Longshore, you have also done some work now for a silent film as well, is that right?
Well, I did years ago, actually. Seattle used to have these sort of evenings of collections of silent films. And so I'd go with a bunch of colleagues and we'd basically improvise scores. And they were pretty amazing scores, actually. They really sounded like compositions. They weren't just sort of a random series of sounds. To diverse films such as films by Man Ray, the very early French films, the Pathé ones. They were fantastic films and it was really such a joy. And I've always loved film and film music, so I'm really excited, and we're really excited to be doing this. This is such a privilege for us.
So what is the project that is being showcased at the film festival for you two?
Yeah, so we have co-composed and will co-perform to three of Stacey Steer's films. She's one of the featured filmmakers and is here for the festival. There are three silent films that she created. They are called Phantom Canyon, Night Hunter, and Edge of Alchemy. And Stacey, she's a really wonderful artist. Her process is she uses imagery, actual images from actors, actresses, iconography from the silent film era, and takes those and collages them into her own animated, amazing stream of consciousness kind of films. And they're just absolutely fascinating.
I've had a chance to see just a few seconds, really, of what she did with the old Mary Pickford films, mm-hmm. and just the amount of color and motion that she's added to those, just it's hard to describe.
Yeah,
which I think is truly incredible.
Yeah.
Let's actually hear some of the music of the people we're talking to in the studio here. So we were just talking to Terry Longshore and Tessa Brinkman. They also are part of a duet with all the other things they have going on. They performed together and composed together as Caballito Negro, for which they joined us in the studio about 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, on April 14th of 2016. So here's a little clip from That Which Colors the Soul.
Bends when I ask for them. Yeah.
Is that us playing in here?
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. Like,
that's not the recording.
I know.
No. So, does it sound very different from what you brought out of the studio, your own studio?
Yeah, yeah. That, we were actually playing that live here in the studio, I think, yes?
Yes, you were.
Yeah, yeah. We've since recorded the piece, and I'm just looking, that didn't sound like the same recording. It's great to hear that again.
Different microphone. There was something you said, Tessa, about a difference between scores and other kinds of music. And mm-hmm. I'm just curious to know about when you're putting music in a place where it's meant to be in accompaniment with images. I mean, how different a process is that from creating for just for people to listen to your music?
Well, it's kind of a circular thing that goes on, I think. I mean, obviously you want sensitivity to the other medium, but also you want the music to be able to stand by itself in some way, you know, so that and what I love about silent film actually is that there's a perfect marriage between a visual medium and the oral medium with the music. You know, often when you're like doing theatre music, it's like, well, there's 5 seconds of you and now on to the stage and more about the stage and then, back to 10 seconds of you and then back to the stage. So it's almost like we're also always being interrupted, you know. And as musicians, we have a lot to say, like, you know, other dramatic forms. So with silent film, it's fantastic to have these sort of complete narratives going, but they have to have utter sensitivity. Of course, the film is already made, but you can feel like there's a dialogue going on when it's really working beautifully. It's just, I so much appreciate film because it's this sort of huge rabbit hole universe that you jump into that gives you so much. It's just ecstatic for me to be creating music for that.
A rabbit hole in the sense that once you're in there, it's hard to find your way out?
Well, not even hard to find a way out, but it's just, it's so huge. It's like the possibilities are endless about what you can say, what you can see inside the film. Every time, you know, especially a beautiful film, you see new things every time, right? And that's so inspiring. If you have leeway in your score to add things, subtract things, or whatever. I mean, there are always sort of pillars which you jump to of major turns or major ideas, changes and things. But one of my favorite mediums is having something that's it's a basic score, but then there's room to morph the sounds and the form.
Tessa Brinkman, Terry Longshore, Joby Talbot, our guests on the Jefferson Exchange, all composers, all have done work for film, and we'll be talking about that this weekend at the Ashland Independent Film Festival. Looks like Sunday at 10 at the Ashland Springs Hotel.
Yeah. Talking about it.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. Another okay. Early morning.
And I guess Caballito Negro. You're actually performing as Caballito Negro this weekend as well.
No.
For the film.
But for the film. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Got
sorry. Yes, we're performing tomorrow. In fact.
Yeah. Is it tomorrow? Right. Yes, it's quite soon. Yeah. I heard a bit of what they've come up with for this for these films, and it's just incredible. Just so beautiful.
Thank you.
I mean, and lots of crazy instruments that even I, who is a obsessive percussion fan, had never seen before.
Oh, yeah, tell us. This would fall into Terry Longshore's realm, the percussion.
Well, each of us plays different instruments on all three films we're doing. So we've taken the opportunity to use a different kind of landscape of sounds for each film. So for the first film, Phantom Canyon, has the largest instrumentation. I'm playing a kind of plethora of percussion instruments, including kalimba, waterphone, udu drum.
Thunder tube.
Okay. Don't never leave home without a thunder tube.
I forget what else. Quite a few things. And Tessa's playing a hybrid flute, toy piano, melodica.
Melodica, yeah.
Yeah. And then for Night Hunter, Tessa plays a beautiful bass flute. It's her newest instrument. It's just a gorgeous instrument. And I play vibraphone. And then for Edge of Alchemy, we both play prepared piano.
Together, sitting on the same bench.
prepared piano?
Prepared piano. So we've inserted all kinds of screws and bolts and felt and other kinds of things into, you know, selected strings of the piano, which creates amazing harmonics and gong-like sounds. Mm-hmm. Was an invention of John Cage's, who we're huge fans of. And we took the opportunity. Edge of Alchemy is the longest film. It's about 20 minutes long and has just a beautiful arc. And very, very kind of creepy at times and kind of a scientific, interesting, I don't know how you might describe it, Tessa.
Well, sort of Victorian kind of images, you know, that have been sort of rescued. So there's biological drawings and such and images. And what I love about Stacey's vision is that there's always an element of subversion there. So she's taking these images, but it's a very modern consciousness, a very female modern consciousness, sort of subverting the tropes about what silent film is, about what science is, about... You know, you can read a lot of different things into it. So that's been really fun for us to
Which is especially interesting because she's doing it with film that is essentially, what, 90, 95 years old?
Right. And, of course, the source material is all in black and white, but she's inserted some really brilliant elements of color, and we've taken that as a genesis for thinking about color, how we introduce color into our own musical works.
So do the Stacey Steers films, I mean, do they tell a story with the on-the-screen dialogue and all that stuff from silent film, or is it just images and art?
It's just images, and you can sort of, you know, you can interpret what the narrative on screen in multiple ways because it's surreal. So there's always this element of, I wonder what that means. Uh-huh. And, you know, and then you get into this wonderful thing of like, well, I don't even care what it means. It's so amazing. So,
Joby Talbot, for The Dying Swan, I mean, is it more of a narrative sort of story then? Does it have on-screen dialogue and all the stuff from silent film era?
It does. Mm-hmm. It's the stories of a ballerina called Gisella who is mute, which is a handy device to have in a silent movie.
Absolutely.
It's a good excuse for why everything she says has to be written down. And she's, I don't want to spoil the story. I don't want to do any... Spoilers, but she, it doesn't end well. Let's just put it that way.
I've wondered in particular about silent films that do have, I keep wanting to call it dialogue. I don't know what else you'd call it, but you know, everything people say to each other has to be put on the screen.
Put it on
an
intertitle,
And I just wonder about what it's like composing for, you know, you have the dramatic parts and then you have to sort of drop back or something for a second.
Well, actually, it's not such a big deal in The Dying Swan because somehow he does kind of neatly incorporate it into what's happening. I mean, she has to write everything she says down in like a pocketbook. And actually, there isn't too much dialogue anyhow. But I'm actually working on another silent film at the moment for a project I'm doing at LA Opera in the fall. And that has just, you just think, how slow are these guys at reading? Can we just move on? So, yeah, it's a problem.
We haven't heard any of Joby Talbot's music yet. I want to let the audience hear some of that. So we have a clip from Tide Harmonic, Movement 1, Dew Point. This is from Some Point in the Middle. So maybe I'm thinking this because of the fact that I was watching this off a YouTube video at the time, but I mean, there's a sense of a movie developing there that kind of music.
Yeah, in fact, my wife, Liz Seymour, made a beautiful movie for that thing, which is on YouTube, out of archival footage, beautiful archival footage of images of water from the 20s and 30s. There's definitely something filmic about a lot of my music. And this start I had doing silent movies really came into its own many years later when I was first asked to start working in ballet, doing narrative ballets. Because people would ask me whether it was like writing film music. But as Tessa was just saying, when you're working in theatre or you know, conventional film, the music very rarely comes to the fore. I mean, it might be playing for a lot of the time, but usually it's just sitting, providing a bed, providing atmospherics behind the dialogue, and rarely comes out front. Whereas in silent movies or ballet, that happens for a lot more of the time. In fact, most of the time, the music's kind of leading the way. I mean, in dance, they're literally dancing to the music.
It tells the story,
And it tells the story. And I mean, again, there's still a dialogue, and sometimes it comes further forward, and sometimes it retreats. But it's much more on show all the time. And it does mean that you can create much longer paragraphs of music, much more interesting, slowly developing architectural musical forms across, you know, several hours sometimes.
Otherwise, then, I mean, if it's underneath the things that are going on, it just has to be sort of a bed. I mean, is it sort of like creating, I don't know, wallpaper music or something?
Well, I mean, you even try and make the wallpapery beds seem interesting, and hopefully that they would work on their own. But yeah, I mean, coming off the back of writing a three-act story ballet or a 50-minute silent film score, to then go and do a conventional movie like Sing, for example, where, you know, a long piece of music would be 2 minutes. quite short compared to the other things.
We are talking about making music for the movies with Joby Talbot, Tessa Brinkman, and Terry Longshore, all featured in talkbacks and some work going on at the Ashland Independent Film Festival, which began last night and runs through Monday. If you want to visit with us, you can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm curious in particular about the Stacey Steers trilogy that Tessa and Terry worked on. Did you just get handed the finished film and said, make sounds for this? Or was it there some chance to get in there before she was finished with the visual process?
No getting in there. I mean, it had already been, made by her and scored. So there's already a score. So Richard offered us this opportunity to do live music, another iteration with her film. So we got sent the videos and we just both turned the sound off, didn't listen to the other version because we really wanted just to come into it fresh. So we actually don't know what the original music sounds like.
So you're not doing that music. So there's a score A and a score B now, essentially, and you're going to be the B team, but you're going to be doing the second version. Let's put it that way.
So the films all were written at different times, and I think the earliest one is from 2002, eight. Oh, I can't remember.
I remember either.
The latest one is quite more recent, but as Tessa mentioned, there are scores to the films, but she has also worked with other composers, I think at least two others previously, to create live music for her work. So, yeah, as Tessa said, we didn't really want to be influenced by that as to how we interpreted the films. So we actually haven't listened to the original score.
The same reason that actors who are doing plays on stage don't want to look at the movie versions of those to get influenced by the
right.
Yeah.
They've actually used one of the stills from one of the films, haven't they, as the main image for the festival.
They have. Anyone, it's a picture of Mary Pickford.
Yeah, anyone wandering around town looking at that beautiful image and wondering where it came from, it's from one of the films that Tessa and Terry are going to be on Saturday.
Richard Herskowitz explained that when he was here on Monday. We've had a whole bunch of people from the Ashland Independent Film Festival here this week. Joby, you had been composing, I'm going to gather, for a while before you did any film work originally. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the first thing you did was a silent gig, right?
Yeah, I did this film, an early Alfred Hitchcock silent from the 20s called The Lodger.
Mm-hmm.
Before he came to Hollywood and started making talkies, he made a ton of silent films in Germany and then in Britain. And it was with Ivan Novello, very, very melodramatic. I remember talking about the intertitles. The intertitles were quite long, but there were endless scenes of just sitting around in the kitchen that were quite tricky to score. But anyway, it's great. And then, from there I got into doing TV. And then, my first proper, big commercial movie was a film called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy back in
2005, was it?
Yeah, thousands of years ago now.
So is there a part of your brain that is just reserved for the particular strictures and form of making movie music?
Well, it used to be something I did quite a lot. I used to do maybe like 3 films a year for a while. But now I just do them if I really want to. I've got so many other things going on. I'm lucky I can kind of pick and choose. It's a wonderful world in which to work, and I love collaborating with people and directors and editors and music editors and of course the musicians themselves. I mean, it's so fantastic to be working with them. And what's really wonderful about doing film music is that you write something and sometimes literally a matter of hours later or minutes later is being performed by like world-class musicians. Whereas you're writing classical music, you finish it and you send it off and months go by and then, finally you show up to the first rehearsal and then it gets done and then that's that. it's a different kind of thing. But, I've always enjoyed doing lots of different things. I think I have quite a low boredom threshold, so it's always good to be working on one thing and moving on to another. And I don't necessarily think about the projects in a completely different way. I mean, I'm always coming with hopefully a kind of honest and true personal response to whatever I'm working on.
Is there a, you mentioned how quickly it can go from composition to playing, and I wonder if there's an extensive revision process in there too. It's like, oh, that didn't quite work with this part of the scene, that sort of thing.
Well, what they tend to do now, and it's a bit, You know, in the old days, it must have been quite terrifying for film directors, because the one part of the process they had really very little control over was what the composer did. I mean, the composer would maybe take them into his studio or her studio and play them some of it on the piano, and they'd say, oh, that sounds nice, go see you on the scoring stage. And then an orchestra would show up and they'd start to play, and if it was all wrong, well, there wasn't very much they could do about it. And I'm sure it was quite hair-raising for the directors and producers. But nowadays, what they want to see is everything kind of mocked up on computers to kind of the nth level. They want to get it to a stage where it really sounds like almost exactly like how it's going to be once you have a real orchestra on it. And it drives me a bit round the bend, really, because it does foster a kind of composer who's really first and foremost a computer programmer rather than a visionary. I mean, you know, the idea that, I mean, the kind of music these guys are making would just not fly in that realm, because it's so, I mean, I'm hearing sounds coming out of these instruments that I've never heard before, and you can't really notate those, you can't demo them up, so you would have sort of difficulty getting that past the kind of revision process in advance of doing the recording. I mean, I'm not saying there's not tons of cool, interesting film music being made, there is, but it's a different process than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Lots of, yeah, and I'm not surprised. Well, it sounds like it's the same process that is used to make popular music now as well, where everything is refined and refined and refined, and then these are the good takes and we'll put them all together. I mean, the way that things are assembled in studios for popular music amazes me, and it's like, well, she sounded better saying this word this way.
Oh, yeah.
It gets that intricate. Mm-hmm. So you guys are going to be playing live, though, with the film, Tess and Terry?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
And so, Joby will as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this really harkens back to, like, you know, the silent film
days. The old days,
yeah. Yep. Well, you have to. Yep. So what is that like, though, to try to perform live in sync with a movie?
It's thrilling, actually, and you just hope that you don't miss stuff, but, you know, it's a very human process, too. So, I mean, the beauty of live performance is that new things come in, and we've written our scores in such a way that we can have new things come in, but we also have to be absolutely attentive to what's going on and to each other, so... It's busy.
Yeah, very much yeah. So give people a chance before we go about where they can... I know you'll all be doing a talk back on Sunday morning at 10, is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, and then what's the other event with you?
Well, the actual film is Saturday night, 8:15 p.m. in the Music Recital Hall at Southern Oregon University.
Music Recital Hall. Okay, good. I had the wrong place written down. Okay, Music Recital Hall, Saturday at 8:15.
Yep. Correct.
To see, and that's the whole trilogy, the whole Stacey Steers trilogy?
Yes.
Yeah, and the Dying Swan and the Dying as well.
Excellent. Yes. All together. Okay, Joby Talbot, Tessa Brinkman, Terry Longshore. Always great to see you guys in the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.